I just wanted well at one episode, which for me was of great future importance. We had visited a small town, which was located on a hillside overlooking a beautiful valley, and in the bottom a mountain stream rushed forward, and I was just about to leave, when we at the city gate met a young woman, who stayed and watched us as if she had recognized us. She was small and Galician in stature, but had nothing willful in her appearance. Her eyes were soft with a sheen of sadness in her eyes. There was something about this look that I could not get past. "Why do you leave this town, without having been inside my house?" she asked. "That's still me you seek." "I do not know you," I said surprised. "But I know you," she said with a conviction, which seemed irrevocable. "You are the Nightake Helgotson, not?" I confirmed that I had once borne the name. "So follow me, good gentleman, we have maybe one or two things to talk about together." She took my hand and led me into her little house, which was located just beside the city gate. A bullet followed silently behind. We entered into a simple and pleasant room, which bore witness to order and diligence. She asked us to sit down in armchairs, while she herself was standing. "It was a time," she said, turning to me, "when the young handsome knight, not scorn a poor maid, whom he met in the woods. Do you remember little Gudrun, which you took in your arms?" At first she was timid, but then she indulged so completely to her lovely knight, that he has never gone out of her mind. "Do you remember that, Gudrun?" I said inquiringly, when I got up from her chair. I was both startled and embarrassed. Memories came up, I long ago thought was obliterated. The fair Gudrun's image was at once so alive to me, that I could not help seeing that it was she who now stood before us. "Yes, you have forgotten me, I see," she continued with a mournful tone, "but I have never forgotten you. Much have I since experienced, but the image of my young knight has so burned itself into my memory, that I would have recognized you where and whenever I met you, in spite of it would have gone 1,000 years. And that I would one day meet you, I knew." The certainty had burned like a little twinkling star in my being's innermost place. It has made me to forget so many hardships that I encountered on my way. It has taught me to believe and hope. And now the miracle happened, that I will meet you here outside my door. "Gudrun, I carry a large debt to you, how can I ever repay it?" "Of that we shall not speak," she said kindly and pushed me back down in the chair, "but indulge me only, the little time I get to keep you, to sit at your feet and hold your hand." She sat on a stool next to me and leaned her head against my knee. "You little Gudrun," I said, stroking her hair, "you have suffered much because of me. Love is to suffer, and I have loved you and no one else in all the centuries, as have gone while waiting for you to come. Would you tell us something about yourself from that time, when we met in the forest?" "What can I say except that you took my heart, without I getting yours? What could I do but cry when you left me and married the beautiful maiden at King Valdemar's hoof? I hid myself with my shame, I gave birth to my child in grief, but I loved it because it was also yours. I was hunted away by my father, because I could not bring myself to say your name. Outcast and despised, I went with my child in my arms from door to door and begged until finally an old man of the priests took care of us, and helped so I got serving by a rich and noble gentleman, who owned an estate near Linköping. There I could stay and take care of his pigs. Yes, God bless the father, who helped us. I never saw him since." A bullard got up and looked at Gudrun with a searching look. "Do you remember what the father was called?" said a bullard. "Yes, that's all I remember of him. His features have faded, but I have to remember his name, in order to take him into my prayers. His name was Ibald. How have I found thee, my daughter, whom I so highly sought after?" said Ibald and stretched out her arms to her. "I suspected that there might possibly be you, now I have confidence. Do you recognize me?" Gudrun had risen and stood with an expression of the utmost astonishment on her face. "You. Are you Ibald? Well, so God bless you," she cried and put her arms around his neck. "You must not wonder that I did not immediately recognize you," she added, "because when I found my knight, he took me so completely. I hardly saw you were with us. Then we talked long together. Gudrun said she had been down to Earth once in a while as a nun of Vadsena Monastery, but had not found the peace she searched for. When I asked what she was doing, and if she liked the part where she lived, she replied, "I live a very lonely life, but here is a hospital, taking care of those who have difficulty finding their right place here, after they have left the mortal life. So I am a helping sister, for I have good hand with the sick, that I learned in the monastery. Do you know anything about he who was then our child? He is currently on earth. There, I follow him as much as my time allows. It is my dearest acquisitions. I only have joy of him." Abulrit stood up and prepared himself to go. "Are you all ready to leave me?" said Gudrun and stretched imploring hands towards us. "I think we take her with us in our journey, if she would like," said Abulrit, and I agreed with all my heart. I thought she was going crazy. She screamed and spun around and was quite wild with joy. Then she fell on my neck and cried while her eyes shone. "Never, never did I think that I would follow you. And never did I think that I would see Abulrit again, and now I follow you both. Blessed be God." Our hike went away to a secluded region high up in the mountains. It was a backwoods, where the road wound its way along the steep slopes, across deep gorges and mountain streams run. The vegetation was initially rich, but slowed down as far as we rose higher. Soon we are perched on a plateau of breathtaking beauty with a crown of snow-covered snowtops around the horizon. But not a tree, hardly a shrub. The only thing that grew was a nice soft grass and large sumptuous flowers. It was so quiet. Not even a bird chirps interrupted the silence. The air was as warm and easy to breathe. Gudrun was cheerful and happy, and she sang as it echoed against the rock. "Where are you leading us?" I asked Abulrit. "Here's the sea desolate. Even the animal world seems to have withdrawn from this district. Not far from here lives an old hermit scholar whom I know since long ago. I wanted to make him a visit. Maybe we will not regret it." Then we went even a little. We saw a curious, somewhat fantastic building sticking out from behind a crag. An old man with white hair and beard came out against us. "I welcome to you," he said. "I knew you would come and I am happy to welcome you. My hut is not big but it holds for all three of you the comfort you needed and the hospitality you need." "God's peace, old Edel," said Abulrit. "You probably know my companions. I need not mention their names. They are my good friends. I have been following them in hundreds of years and I knew that one day they would call me. Good to see them together, and it's you, old friend, who brought them to me for this time. You are thrice welcome. It always in my thought to lead him to you, but not knowing, when we started on our journey, that I also had luck to meet her and to be the one who brought her here. Destiny's roads are wonderful." Gudrun and I saw surprise then at the old, and so at each other. "Why are you living here so lonely, far from other people?" I asked. "Do you not feel how clean the air is? You do not perceive the solemn stillness, as prevails here? Then can you not understand how well this place is dedicated to the studies I pursue?"
"What studies?"
I ventured to throw out. "Come and see," he said, and brought us into a large room, which looked like a scientific laboratory. In all tables and shelves were instruments of many kinds, binoculars, sextant scales, crucibles and things. Even those preparations, in an infinite variety. Gudrun went around and looked at all these for her, saw strange things, lifted them and put them gently back down. "You know more than others, I can tell," she said, "but what exactly do you study?"
"Nature, nothing but nature," said the old man, and his eyes shone with joy, while his mouth pulled into a beautiful smile.
"But," he added, "nature is infinite in the large and the small, and also not eternity sufficient for those who want to penetrate into all its secrets. Is nature so attractive that you want to sacrifice centuries of studying it?" asked Gudrun. "Not only nature, as it appears to our senses, but what lies behind."
"What is behind?"
"The Great Spirit, who never started and never stopped. He is, and never changed. He who bears everything without getting tired, he who, with his gentle breath warms every little life seed, so that it turns into a flower, and each trembling human heart, so that it opens up and tremble with joy,
Have you seen this spirit? Nobody has seen him, or ever see him, not even the Hajj Arabs, who is his messengers. But by getting on the trails of the laws, he wrote into his nature, I walk as in his tracts, thinking his thoughts after and for each new little step I add to the chain of old truths, prying my heart with joy. Praise be God. It was a glorified light over the old man's face, and he raised his hands as if he had thanked anyone. Then he took us into his study, as on all the walls had shelves of books and folios. On the desk lay piles of paper and old parchment scrolls. On one wall was a broad bench, covered with a pillow and some soft cushions. Here he bade us be seated, while he himself went about doing something. First he took out an old jar and then he came with three crystal goblets. This is my only dear guests, he said as he poured out the golden wine. I myself consumes nothing. You have probably often guests, said Dibord. Yes, they come from above and below to help me in my studies and themselves to become helped. Uplift you now with my wine, it have no intoxication. And be most welcome my dearest guests, who I for centuries have been waiting for. Yes, you mentioned that you followed us over the centuries and that you felt that we are coming, I said. Can you explain why you expected us? I'd love to, he said, and took place in an old leather upholstered armchair across from us. Do you remember a time when you were my master? You were the Hansonite Kalgetson at King Voldemar's court and I was a poor woodcutter addle at your farm? Was it you who helped me find the trace of her elapsed from me? So it was. I live in an inn now, a little apart from other people, deep in the forest's gloom. Dreams and premonitions filled my being. Even during previous shifts in my life I had studied the secrets of nature and cultivated certain occult powers which made me I hear and see more than other people, but it did not touch myself too close, because then I was both blind and deaf. I was married and had one daughter. She grew up as a beautiful star flower in the woods. She was my pride and joy. Since her mother passed away, it was she who took care of our little home and watched our goats. But one day she came home violated and would not confess who the man was, who sullied her honor. I tried with secret powers get him on the tracts, but always in vain, and it was well. For if I had succeeded, I might have been stained by his blood. Then she insisted not wanting to give the name of seducer. I was hard and pushed her away from me. It was an act, which I bitterly regret. I have then looked for her on earth and in the spheres, until finally her mother gave me the clue to her. I could then inconspicuously accompany her on all her ways, but dared not give me known for the feeling of fear that she would feel from the unnatural father, who shunned her. This has been my suffering through the centuries. Since my mind has settled, I have not had difficulty finding the man who caused our misfortune, and even him, I have followed. Not with thoughts of revenge, but with a desire to once again get to see them both happy by each other. For in depth of their beings I've read the secret, on which life's happiness depends. Of the exalted master who leads my studies, I have got the advice to wait patiently until they both would look me up. It has seemed to me as a hopeless and endless waiting. And many a time have my hopes failed, but now, finally, I have you both with me. He stretched his arms out against us and took us both with indescribable tenderness in his arms. Gudrun had, as he spoke, crept to him and took his hand, which she covered with kisses. I had a wonderful sensation of something in my inmost being opened, and through this opening, I saw in a vision a perspective of happiness, which filled me with an old not known bliss. It lasted maybe only for a moment that vision, but I felt that now I was facing a new phase of my development, new battles and new breaks, but also new possibilities of happiness would come to fruition. Abulra left us now. He went to seek others who needed him more, he said. He took us in his arms and expressed his hope that soon we would meet again. Then he wrapped his cloak round himself, and disappeared with wonderful speed from our sight. It was a happy time we spent with Adol, lucky for us and happy for him. He left for a time his studies and devoted himself entirely to our upbringing. Many words of wisdom he gave us and many strange mysteries he understood to be solved. He was indefatigable to answer all our childish questions. But once I searched to explore him about the future, He became serious and only answered, "Do not ask about the future. It will not stand to be touched by unscrupulous hands. Know that we are at every moment of our lives built on our future. Well or bad, we build. It is our own hand which adds stone to stone on our future and destiny. But if we look for finding the coming future, to penetrate into it, and we want to look in detail how it will be carved, then we anticipate the higher authority, which supervises and leads the work, and interfere with the cooperation that should prevail. Between this secret over self-power or the timid spirit of power in our own being. The more, however, we are in childlike faith, leave us entirely devoted to this guidance and belief in its infallible power, the more firmly we build, and the more beautiful the building is. No doubt there are those who own a certain ability to penetrate in the future of obscurity, and the temptation is great to do it, but it is always associated with dangers, not least on to become mocked by a mirage, which could become a reality, but that was inadequate, as it would take the form of crude or unscrupulous hands. Sometimes our soul rests in solemn silence. It may, without pursue it, catch a glimpse of it, that the future will bring, but then it is something that is given us, not something we grasp for, and its meaning is only to strengthen our faltering faith and warm our frozen faith." "Have you had such insights into the future?" I asked. "It had it for myself, but often enough for those I love. As you might have seen something that concerns us, there you drawn to throw forth. Are you still searching, eliciting for me a secret, as would be best for you not to know?" said Etta with a friendly smile. "Life is always a struggle with the fate we'd created ourselves, but on our side is he or she, it, that holds all the threads in his hand and leading us with a wisdom that is never mistaken and with a love that never fails. It may be sufficient for you to know." He took her head between his hands and kissed her tenderly on the forehead. 13. And overcome temptation for the fourth time, I was born in Sweden, this time in one of our major provincial cities, where my father was a merchant. It was close to our time. Remember, this book was first published in Sweden more than 100 years ago. It was in the 1820s. My name was Berger. More specifically, I will not tell who I was or where I lived. Since I completed the cathedral school and by distress strived me through high school, I was sent to Uppsala to continue my studies. My father wanted me to study to become priest, but it went bad with his studies. Instead, I was drawn more and more into delirious entertainment among cheerful and frivolous student friends. I just had no greater talent, was neither a singer or composer, or poet, but I was a nice fellow, who did not reject drinking with friends. There was something good-natured and inoffensive in my being, and I was happy with a good joke. This was really esteemed by the comrades. In the student group, I made acquaintance with a bachelor of arts which I in this story call George. He was a gifted nature, very musical, played, sang and composed and was really liked by the colleagues. He would become something. He was also of a wealthy family. His father was a wealthy industrialist from mining district. We had seen each other a few times and I felt from the first moment especially drawn to him. It felt like we had been old acquaintances. So it was, in reality, because it was my former brother and creditors Eric, I've met. Late one evening, when we walking home, arm in arm, from a festive feast on the local nation courtroom, George began to talk with an undertone of sadness about life's dark problems, which we never came to any solution on. "The whole of existence is of course a big question mark," he said. "We know neither where we come from or where we go. Yes, not even what will happen to us tomorrow. Therefore, let us live in the moment and be happy for the day," I objected. "Yes, there is probably no other advice, and though I would give a lot to get a glimpse into the future and get a sense of what's coming. Do you consider yourself, more than others, to have any reason to explore the future? Curious could we all be, but I think it's a wise arrangement of Providence to keep a veil for our future destinies." "Yes, call it curiosity or whatever you want, but it would interest me to know what that means, that it so often comes over me a gloomy feeling of an accident which shall befall me." "Then I think, you especially should be grateful to not knowing about it in advance. Dismiss these thoughts. They probably have nothing to signify. Enjoy life while you have it. drink and be merry, that's my philosophy. Yes, you take life easy, easier than I think you should, if you really intend to become a priest. He did it not without a certain sharpness on particular the last word. I was suddenly quiet and serious. It was so unexpected, yet none of his comrades, and no one else made me some reproaches for my Uppsala life. Uppsala equals city in Sweden. That a student of theology took the studies as easily as the other faculties were considered at the time, quite naturally, so nobody took notice thereby. But these Georg's words burned into my mind. I felt at first little set back by his tone of talk, but swallowed the bitter pill and said after a moment, "Well, who knows what it might become of me, old waster? I read the Bible because the old man wants it. And as long as I do what he wants, he sends money, but I know him. If I should not do what he want, it would soon be end of money." "You therefore have no inner calling to become a priest?"
"No."
"Inner calling?"
"No, I have never really known. I would far rather be an officer. It has always played good mood at me, but..."
"Do you know, Brajur, I think you should throw the priest collar and take epaulettes, then it will become something whole of you. Write to the old man and tell him that you want to change saddle."
"Yes, it would probably be a good excuse, but..."
"Well, I will think about it." We shook hands and farewell and parted. A year after, I lay as much compasses in Stockholm. The old man had brought out and threatened to repeal the maintenance and making me disinherited, but my mother, who felt that his uniform would adorn the family more than cassock, laid out for me and I got my own way. However, it was with regret I parted from the happy student life and my former comrades. In particular, it seemed heavy to be separated from Georg, but the hope that after the studies, would settle in Stockholm, to exclusively pursue musical studies. This hope eased the pain of parting. He also came soon after and went into the musical academy, in order to devote himself to composition. We often met and held, between our exercises and studies, what you call a nice bachelor life. One day Georg up to me and talked with joy beaming in countenance, that he was engaged to the daughter of a senior government official. Her name was Gunhild and of course was delightful. They had met at a few balls and so it was done. George had told about his friendship to me and now I was also invited to her parents at the engagement party. With excited curiosity I entered in the elegant drawing room and was to greet the deputy director and his wife and there she came. Yes, I must confess that she was pretty. But it was so strange, almost lug inside me, when I saw her. It was like it opened in my being a window through which I could look out over a vast beautiful landscape, as well as something smiled at me, a strange feeling, which disappeared as quickly as it came. Was it an instinctive idea that I had met an old friend? Because in fact it was Ingetra, who hid behind Gunhild's beautiful features. I took her hand and congratulated her on the engagement. "You're a close friend of George," she said artlessly. "I hope you even want to be there for me." Now followed a series of parties within the family and because of my friendship with George, I was invited and soon came in a near contact with Gunhild. She was generally little shy, but she treated me from the first moment like an old friend, and I felt soon so at home in the office of the council salon, as if I myself would be son-in-law of the house. Georg was nothing but sunshine and happiness. He also was everyone's favorite. The wedding was over and the young couple had immigrated in the little tasteful and pretty furnished apartment at Regeringsgatan. It was a delightful home, but best of all was the hostess herself with her feminine graceful and yet so simple essence and heart-twinning kindness. Yes, I must confess that I can hardly hold back a sense of envy of all the good that has fallen on Georg's lot, more so, as I had a secret sense that he did not fully appreciate his luck. He lived much of his music and studied hard, but lived the rest of his time, in my opinion, a somewhat extroverted nightlife. Many a time, I came up to spend a pleasant evening in this home, where I was often guest, I found Gunhild home alone. George was at a club, where it was chamber music, or any company, where he was asked to sing, but Gunhild did not feel inclined to follow. I could then for a while, sit down and talk quite intimately with her alone, but walked away with a certain oppression,
which I did not do any effort to further analyze. I just felt that I should tell Georg to better appreciate the treasure he had, but it was never said. Why should I interfere in their intimate life? Georg was, moreover, a strange man, composed of many different elements. He was stubborn more than willed, but at the same time easily attracted to changing things. He wanted to be with people out in life and even see happy guests in his home, but was else quite in melancholy. He had a large fund of seriousness and sense of justice, but could sometimes, especially in business, be foolish frivolous. It was the artist temperamentet, which with its different moods pressed their mark on him. But anyhow he was, all kept well of him, and he had a kind of privilege to do what he pleased. A sensitive point was always his compositions. On the one hand, he was very sensitive to any criticism, on the other, he self thought nor of his own talent. It was within him a constant battle between self-esteem and despair, which seemed to hamper his ability to work. A fact was, that he never got anything completely finished. When they had been married for 1 year, it came over him an irresistible urge to travel to Dresden to study music with a famous teacher at conservatory. Gunhild had become mother and her little boy kept her tied to home. She had no inclination to leave the quiet home life against the troubled, broken life in a foreign boarding house. So he traveled alone in the fall and would come back for Christmas. It was a few weeks later. I had not in a long time heard anything about or from Georg, and therefore went up to Gunhild to hear of any news from Dresden. She came herself and opened the hall door and was so happy when she saw me, that I felt quite warm in heart. I even got to follow her on tiptoe into the bedroom and see little Kurt, who was lying there so rosy-cheeked and slept with one hand tied over the dune. "Yes, you are lucky," I said, "who have everything so well ordered. Oh, if I was there." There came a wistful, almost anxious pull over Gunhild's face as she answered, "No luck is perfect. Here, however, I thought, should be." "Bonjour," she said, and laid her hand on my shoulder, "you have been to me as a dear brother. I feel that I can trust you, and therefore I want to speak frankly. I have no one to confide to." "What is it, Gunhild?" I asked in excitement. "Come, let us go out into the atrium, so we do not disturb Kurt." She invited me to sit down in an armchair and took place herself on a chair close beside me. "There is perhaps nothing," she continued with a light vibrating voice, "and yet it feels so heavy. I'm afraid," it was cloaked in the throat and she had to swallow a few times, "I'm afraid I am not for Georg what he expected it to be." "How can you think of such a strange thought, so completely unfounded? I can then witness, that he repeatedly talked about how happy he is. I find it hard to believe so, as he can go out there alone without being homesick. Yes, without even write home and ask how we are and how it is with Kurt." Big tears rolled down her cheeks and mouth were an expression of pain. "Has he not done so? It is now 3 weeks since I had a letter and it contained nothing which could be interpreted as he is missing us. It was only about his own person, how he worked and had fun out there. Such is lean diet for a hungry heart." She leaned her head against my shoulder and sobbed aloud. "Yes. We men are incorrigible egoists," I replied. "We think only of ourselves, and if we have a dear little wife, who sweetens life for us, so we think it's just as it should be. But Gunhild," I stroked her lightly over the hair, "I think you drag your conclusions wrong, because George loves you as much as before. I can assure you, it's just his usual thoughtlessness. He does not understand what you are longing for." It snapped a door. A maiden looked inside, but pulled straight back and closed the door. Gunhild stood up, wiped her eyes and went out and asked what she wanted. I felt a little embarrassed by the situation and, when Gunhild came back, I took my hat and said goodbye. She looked at me with a look that was almost begging for affection and said to me in a weak tone of voice, "Come again soon. I am so terribly alone." I went up a street and down, while conflicting emotions tumbled into my chest. Yet I felt the hot head against my shoulder, and in my mind I caressed tenderly the silky, smooth hair. What was the hot waves pouring out of my mind? Was it just the fraternal friendship, I always had had for her, or was it but that must be fought? I may not make my friend unhappy. Well, maybe it could apply to all three of us.